The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at the Bulwark, and I'm joined by our regulars, Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and the Wall Street Journal, Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center, and Damon Linker, who writes the Substack newsletter Notes from the Middle Ground. Our special guest this week is Joe Klein, longtime political reporter, columnist, foreign policy guru, and most famously, the author of the originally anonymous, but later it was revealed, author of Primary Colors, which for our younger listeners was a huge blockbuster book that got made into a movie about the Clinton campaign of 1992. Those days seem unbelievably innocent from our perspective now. But let's move straight to the news of the week, because we had two things that I want to start off with. The linkage between these two items, Nikki Haley and Sam Alito, is simply that they cause heartache and dismay for those of us who used to be affiliated with the conservative movement and the Republican Party. Let us start with Nikki Haley, who continues to receive votes in Republican primaries, about 20% of the vote, despite the fact that she dropped out 2 months ago. She had become sort of the repository of the hopes, or at least the protests, of a section of the Republican Party that is not okay with Trump. And as our colleague at the Bulwark, A.B. Stoddard, pointed out, it would have been really important and inspirational for her to at least do a Mike Pence, to at least fail to endorse Trump. But yesterday she went ahead and said that she was voting for him. And she said she was doing so, Linda, I'm going to start with you. She said she was doing so because she wanted to support a candidate who stands by our allies and opposes our enemies.
Right.
Of all the things to say.
That was flabbergasting. I mean, it just floored me. I was amazed at that. But I wasn't terribly surprised. As regular listeners know, I've been a skeptic of Nikki Haley from the beginning. I have always thought that she was one of the most opportunistic and ambitious politicians. And I think that's what this is all about. Does she really support Donald Trump? I mean, she didn't come out and endorse him. I never expected her to endorse Joe Biden. But I do think that what she is doing is trying to preserve a way forward for herself and her own ambition in the Republican Party. And Mona, you and I left the Republican Party. There are many of us who do not feel comfortable in the Republican Party any longer, but there are people like Nikki Haley who see the Republican Party as their only way to move into higher office. And so that was what she was trying to preserve. I think it's a fantasy to think that the Republican Party in any way at this point can divorce itself from Donald Trump. Everything that is happening now suggests that the two are one. Donald Trump is the Republican Party, and the Republican Party is Donald Trump. And so she wants a future in Republican politics. She saw this as the only way to give her even a chance at that. I don't necessarily think that the 20% or so of her voters will all join her in voting for Donald Trump. But neither do am I, you know, really confident that many of them are going to vote for Joe Biden either. I think we're going to see low turnout in this election, and it is exactly those kinds of voters on the Republican side, and for different reasons, low turnout on the Democratic side for some of the base of the Democratic Party.
Joe, before leaving the outrage of what she did, it's important to just read some of the statements that she was making. Actually, our colleague Andrew Egger at The Bulwark had a great line in his Morning Shots newsletter where he was quoting these statements of hers. And he said she was making these comments, bear in mind, just a couple months ago. He said, you probably still have butter in your refrigerator that you bought when she was making these comments. So these kinds of things. If you mock the service of a combat veteran, you don't deserve a driver's license, let alone being president of the United States. Anybody that can't call out a dictator, that's a problem. Putin has been emboldened by Trump because Trump is not willing to stand up for our allies. She said, this is a man who put us $8 trillion in debt. This is a man who praised China's President Xi a dozen times after China gave us COVID. This is a man who now wants to go and put 10% tariffs across the board, et cetera. And we don't want a king in America, she said. Okay, apparently those comments are no longer operative. So comment on that, if you will, and then let's talk about the political implications. She thinks that she is preserving her political future in the Republican Party. What do you make of the chances of that?
Not great, because the Republican Party isn't Nikki Haley's party anymore. In this month's Atlantic, the editor of the Atlantic, Jeff Goldberg, launched a roundhouse punch at Rob Portman, the former senator from Ohio, which to me was, I guess this isn't even a metaphor anymore, it was like shooting a puppy. I mean, you know, Portman is a lovely guy. He's an educated guy. He was one of the most civilized and thoughtful Republicans. But Goldberg landed on him because he refused to vote to impeach Donald Trump. And this is something that's been a mystery to me as a certified moderate these days. People like Portman, people like Lamar Alexander, people like Nikki Haley, what's in it for them? I mean, I don't think that Donald Trump is about to, make Nikki Haley or anybody who has shown even the slightest bit of independence his vice president. Is she angling for Secretary of State? Is Portman angling for something? Do they want to be part of that? The Republican Party, and I'm sure that, you know, I've heard all of you say this in the past, but it's no longer really a conservative party. And I believe that democracy is best run by moderate conservative parties. The Republican Party is a radical populist party of ignorance at this point. And this is just the latest in a series of terrible disappointments.
Yeah, Bill, it is a terrible disappointment, even though those of us who've been Haley watchers have not had our hopes up, because she has flipped on this so many times in the past. You know, she denounced him in 2016. She then undenounced him and went to work for him. She then denounced him after January 6th. She then undenounced him and said she would not run if he ran. She then ran anyway, even though he was running. I mean, you really can't take to the bank anything that Nikki Haley says. But the question is not so much about Nikki Haley as it is about the segment of the Republican Party that parked their votes with her in the primaries as protest. The fact that she has done this does not, to me, suggest, and I'd be curious to hear your views, it doesn't suggest to me that she is going to be leading those people to vote for Trump. I don't think they were Haley voters in that sense at all. I don't think she has any influence over them. What's your evaluation of that?
I have been eagerly scanning every poll I can get my hands on to see some signs of Republican breaks from Donald Trump at the rank and file level. I have found zero evidence that this is occurring. And it looks at this point as though Trump is going to get as high a share of the Republican vote this year as he did last in 2020 and in 2016. So, you know, Haley may in fact be following the people she was supposed to be leading because, you know, they are backing her, but there's no sign that they won't end up with Trump in a dyadic choice. Some of them may stay home, a few of them, but I think very few Haley voters will go for any third party candidate like RFK Jr. If you have any education, and most of her supporters are the more educated Republicans, they won't have anything to do with RFK Jr. So I think most of them were always destined to end up back with Trump in the end, for very much the reasons that she ended up with Trump back in the end. So from that standpoint, I'm disappointed in her, but not because I thought that she could lead her followers to some new, as yet unidentified political promised land. I will say that this is a clarifying moment for another reason. If there is going to be the proverbial fight for the soul of the Republican Party, she has taken herself out of the running as the person to lead it. And that leaves a lane for some more, you know, a more traditional Republican who thinks it's worth mounting the challenge to organize it, to try to come up with a better political and intellectual and rhetorical and institutional base for that kind of challenge to Trumpism. I don't know who that's going to be. A lot of people have turned down that role, as far as I can tell. Larry Hogan declined, despite being implored by lots and lots of people we all know to take it on. He declined to do so. Maybe it is a fool's errand, but it is a battle worth fighting, especially now. And it needs a credible leader, and we shall see whether anyone steps forward, but it will not be her.
Damon, some people, you know, political prognosticators would say, well, if Trump were smart, he would tap her for vice president. This would reassure all the normies who would no longer be tempted to stay home, and they would flock to him and he'd win by a comfortable margin. I don't think that's entirely a wrong analysis, but I would just say that Trump's peculiar psychology and prejudices will probably get in the way. The psychology part is that he doesn't want anybody that he doesn't think he can completely control. And he has reason to suppose that she is not completely controllable and loyal. And the other reason is he said it back in 2020. He said it many times in his career and public life. He doesn't think that she has the right look. That is, her skin is too dark. Like, he wouldn't want a vice president who is female and a woman of color, because he is afraid that his, you know, racist white backers would be offended. What do you make of that?
Sounds plausible to me. I mean, you know, Nikki Haley and the hopes invested in her, and a kind of a faint echo of that is heard in this discussion, like, will she maybe be the vice presidential choice, is a distant echo of the post 2012 autopsy report that argued that to keep winning the presidency, or at least to be seriously competitive for the presidency, the Republican Party needs to moderate on immigration. It needs to moderate on a lot of the social issues, like especially gay marriage, maybe less so abortion. And that has proven, you know, I at the time, though I was no longer a Republican then, I had thought that sounded totally reasonable to me. And that's why when Jeb Bush was lurking around in 2014, I wrote one of the least long-lived columns in my history for the week titled, "It's Over, It's Jeb," because I figured he was just going to be the next guy. And it would have followed in the kind of McCain, then Romney, well, let's try Jeb now. He has the name Bush, Bush's win, we know that can happen. But it didn't work out that way, and Trump completely flipped it and went in this other direction of like kind of white supremacist grievance politics combined with some legitimate populist grievances and so forth. And we can debate about that direction. But the idea that Trump might choose Haley for any kind of sop to kind of moderate members of the party doesn't strike me as being sensible as far as the way he thinks. Now, I can see that at a certain level, the reason why he's keeping Tim Scott around, you know, the other South Carolinian who sort of flirted with being an anti-Trump vehicle and then just fell in line far more obsequiously than Haley had. So far, enough that he'll even go on, you know, cable television talk shows and refuse to say, you know, whether one should, you know, accept a loss in the 2024 election.
And refuse to say that Trump lost in 2020.
Right, yeah. Right. Although, you know, Haley has herself sometimes been a little dodgy on that too, but she is a little bit better than Tim Scott. But, you know, he keeps him around and I think Nikki Haley around for a different reason, which is that, well, maybe I'll pick one of them just to continually every day prove to the old Republican Party that I'm boss. I'm going to humiliate these people every day from the moment they accept being my vice president until the end of when I leave office in, I don't know, 2032 or something. And so I don't see that she has much of a future in that. And I agree with, I think, versions of what Joe and Bill both said, that I don't think she has much of a future in the Republican Party at all, though I do think that's the motivation or primary motivation for why she's come down here. She represents the past of the Republican Party and a path that it wanted to take but did not take because Trump wouldn't let it. He came on the scene and he activated a different kind of electorate. And the Republican Party, despite their concealed kind of behind the scenes grumbling about Donald Trump the person, I think by now, almost all of them have been convinced that, well, yeah, Trump the person is a lunatic and we have to just smile and nod and hopefully keep the country from being driven into a ditch by this guy. But his change in what the Republican Party is, the kind of voters it appeals to, the kinds of appeals it makes to voters, that I think is an argument that has been won on that Trumpian side. And you know, Nikki Haley can pretend that she's, you know, the next coming of Trump in 2028 if she wants, but I don't think anyone is going to buy it. They're going to want someone who has that authenticity, that populist authenticity, which is BS. But the capacity to sell the BS in this kind of emotionally resonant way, Trump somehow masters that crazy amalgam. And I don't think Nikki Haley has got that.
So they want the authentic populism, and so they're going to turn to somebody like J.D. Vance of Yale Law School.
Who can fake it.
Who can fake it, yeah. Okay.
Exactly. Authenticity. If you can fake that, you've got it made.
Yeah. Okay, let's look at this episode with Justice Alito. The Wall Street Journal editorial board says, oh, they won't stop criticizing these wonderful conservative judges. Why are they saying these nasty things about conservative judges? Now, look, nobody's saying anything about Gorsuch. Nobody's saying anything about Roberts. They're saying things about people who have done very, very questionable things. So this week, it turns out that we learned from the New York Times that Justice Alito's house, we don't know if he personally did it, but their house, flew an upside-down American flag just a few days after January 6th. This symbol of turning the flag upside down, it has a long history and it is a sign of distress, but it was closely associated with the Stop the Steal movement and with the attack on the U.S. Capitol. The Alito's explanation for this was, well, somebody in our neighborhood had used the C word against his wife. Okay, that's very upsetting, no question. Very upsetting encounter. Don't see how the right response is to go fly an insurrectionist flag, though. Okay, but there were people who were saying that, you know, she may not have known that that's what the flag signified. Okay, and then a few days later, it comes out that over their beach house in New Jersey, the Alitos were flying this other flag, which is appeal to heaven flag, which is, again, associated with white supremacy, with Christian nationalism, and with the most extreme MAGA wing of the Republican Party. And there is no story here about a fight with a neighbor, not that that would necessarily be exculpation. But the response among people like the Wall Street Journal editorial pages, oh, this is just politics. Why are they coming after these fine judges? Joe Klein, how do you react as a certifiable, not certifiable, certified centrist?
Certifiable too, probably, because centrism appears to be, advertisement for myself, my Substack is called Sanity Clause.
Is that a reference to the Marx Brothers?
Absolutely. It's a reference to Chico Marx in A Night at the Opera, where he is looking through this contract and he says, there ain't no Sanity Clause. But in any case, you know, sanity is surprisingly hard to come by these days. And we're in an era where almost every American institution, with the possible exception of the U.S. military, and wait until Donald Trump gets hold of that again, almost every American institution is being ripped apart, torn down, and committing suicide, as it is in the case of the Supreme Court. Interesting thing about the that flag, it's called also called the pine tree flag, and I try to keep up on the heraldry of the American Revolution, but I can't remember it ever being one of the major flags of the American Revolution. And I think that in the case of the Supreme Court, my reaction is, what you gonna do about it? The occasional attempts by liberals to try and pack it, expand it, whatever, those aren't going anywhere. And I think that what centrists and liberals and rational conservatives have to deal with, as I think Will Rogers once said, the Supreme Court follows the election returns. And these people were appointed to the Supreme Court because Donald Trump won in 2016, and he beat...
Well, not Alito.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
Alito was an avatar of idiotic extremism, although I don't think that the George W. knew how extreme at the time. But I do think that this is just another sign of the times. Not only are these people extreme, but both Alito and Clarence Thomas are demonstrably corrupt. And democracy requires a certain amount of rigor. You know, Machiavelli once said that otio, indolence, was the greatest enemy of a republic. And the opposite virtue was called virtue, which meant rigor. Machiavelli was worried about how do you keep a republic coherent when it's not at war, when it's at peace? And we've had the greatest period of peace and prosperity in human history over the last 75 years. And, you know, one of the things I've learned during my time covering the military is that they represent a sense of responsibility and service and sobriety and community that the rest of society has lost. And I think that as long as this remains, you know, a republic of lassitude, we're going to continue to see institutions like the Supreme Court, you know, fall apart.
Damon, Chief Justice Roberts is famously quite concerned about the court's reputation, about its legitimacy, about it being perceived as fair. Some people think he's sort of husbanding that respect for a crisis moment when people's trust in the Supreme Court could be dispositive and prevent serious civil strife in this country. But it seems that the accumulation of things, the ethical accusations against Clarence Thomas, and now this really quite shocking revelations about Alito's lack of judgment here. He's been on the Supreme Court for decades. He knows that this kind of political signaling is antithetical to his role. He did it anyway. Roberts has, you know, he can't fire them. but one would hope that he would recognize this as a threat to the reputation of the court, potentially very serious one. What do you think?
Well, one might think so. But as you said, he has no power over them other than calling them into his office, shutting the door and, you know, trying to yell at them into submission, like you are doing damage to this institution. Please stop. But I don't even know if it would come to that. I will actually. This is be one of these weird times when, like, I beg to differ over something that seems like that might be kind of trivial, but I actually think it matters a little bit. Which is, I don't actually think this flag stuff is that important. I don't know what symbols mean to the people who invoke them. I would much rather focus on what Alito says and writes in his voluminous public record. And that I know what it means because he makes the arguments and he provides the evidence as he sees it. And by that alone, I think it's very clear that he and Thomas are the most rightward members of the court, and I disagree with them on that basis. And I honestly don't know what Sam Alito thinks of these two flags, what he thought about raising them, where he did and when he did them. And I would caution commentators from going too far down a kind of spiral of kind of Trump madness where we're like arguing with each other over kind of hidden motives and what things mean or imply and assuming we know what they mean and imply, when there's all kinds of great evidence right there on the surface to point to show that Thomas and Alito are right-wing extremists. Certainly after the oral argument over immunity a few weeks ago, I have absolutely no faith, just based on what I heard, that the two of them will vote to say, get the hell out of here. Of course, a president can be prosecuted for trying to overthrow the government. I think they would have plenty of arguments to back up their endorsement of Trump's extreme immunity claims that have really no direct connection to whether they fly a flag or whether they thought the insurrectionists at the Capitol on January 6th were getting a fair shake or have gotten a fair shake in their prosecutions and so forth. So, I mean, I guess I don't like seeing my side, which I'm defining here as the anti-Trump side, broadly defined from former Republican center right all the way over to the left, getting sucked into a kind of fight over what do symbols mean and whether we can impeach a Supreme Court justice over what this clearly means when we don't know if he understands it that way. So that's how I view it. I don't like Alito. I didn't like the Dobbs decision that he wrote the majority opinion for, and I didn't like all 100 pages of it, or however long. It was around 100 pages long. And like, my view of him hasn't really changed because of this news about these flags. And I don't quite understand the desire to find some sign that there's something even more nefarious going on. Now, if he gave a speech or in an opinion actually tried to justify some of Trump's more outlandish statements about the last election, future election, presidential powers, again, which he might do in the immunity case, that I would go after, and maybe that will be impeachment worthy. But again, that's my contrarian irritant for today.
Thank you for that. That's what we're here for, is for civil disagreement. Okay, Linda.
Begging to differ, yes.
Begging to differ, that's our brand. So Linda, we're making too much of the symbolism here, of the flags. What do you say?
I beg to differ, Mona. I'm sorry. I think the symbolism is important. I always apply the put the shoe on the other foot test. Let's say that Justice Sotomayor or any of the liberal justices decided to raise the Black Lives Matter flag and had done so maybe even during the protests. I don't think that Republicans would think that was okay. And so I do think these symbols matter. I also beg to differ a little with Damon. I'm not 100% sure we know from the questions asked during oral arguments, how any of the justices are going to rule. But I have a different issue I'd like to talk about in terms of Alito, and it applies to Clarence Thomas as well. These are two very angry men. And I knew Clarence Thomas, worked with him when he was in the Reagan administration. I lobbied for his elevation to the Supreme Court, have had some dealings with him since he became a Supreme Court justice. And he is a very angry man about what happened to him and what he called a high-tech lynching during his confirmation hearings, a term, by the way, that I had used even before he did.
So he got it from you?
Yeah, he got it from me. I don't know. I was on the Phil Donahue show, actually. So it was actually pretty widely covered at the time. But Justice Alito, I trace back this anger to him to 2010, when he attended the State of the Union, when Barack Obama blasted the Supreme Court in what I thought were not only unfair, but inaccurate terms on the Citizens United case, which, as listeners may recall, had to do with campaign financing. The court decided that campaign contributions or financing were in fact legitimate political speech, and that corporations and unions could use their money, not corporations directly giving it to candidates, but in airing ads, etc. And when Obama gave his State of the Union address, Justice Alito sat there, began vigorously shaking his head, and I believe he mouthed the words, "not true." I believe that was the last time that Justice Alito attended a State of the Union. I know he didn't attend them even during the Trump era. And I think he became very angry at that point. And this kind of anger, this, you know, visceral kind of reaction to the views of people with whom we disagree, the personalizing of that, I think has played a role. And Justice Alito, I sometimes agree with him on court decision. There have been many times when I've agreed with him on court decisions. So it's not his judicial philosophy or his judicial reasoning that I think is a problem. I do think it's this personal animus. And the flying of these flags, whether you know that the upside down flag, American flag, was used on January 6th, or whether or not you just consider it an international symbol of distress, to me is irrelevant. And in terms of the pine tree flag, just having a justice who, you know, has to weigh in on religious liberty cases, flying a flag over his house or allowing it to be flown over his house that says an appeal to heaven, I think is problematic. So even if you divorce it from what goes on the radical right, I think both of these instances indicated very poor judgment, whether it was his wife who hoisted that flag or someone else. He knew it was there. He saw it flying there. And it was, I think, his way of expressing anger.
Yeah. Bill Galston, there are rules about recusal and about conflicts of interest that apply to all judges and magistrates. And the Supreme Court used to be immune from that. They then adopted a code of conduct that incorporates many of those same standards, but not all of them. And instead of the word shall in the guidelines for everybody else, where, you know, a judge shall recuse himself under these circumstances, the Supreme Court code of conduct that they all adopted last year says should. But let me just read to you the standard for disqualifying himself or recusing himself. Says, should disqualify himself in any proceeding in which his impartiality might reasonably be questioned. And that is really what's at issue here, because by behaving this way, hasn't Justice Alito, I mean, all judges have personal opinions, but part of being a judge is at least giving the impression that you are open to differing points of view and that you haven't prejudged things, right? And flying these flags tends to undermine that, don't you think?
I beg to agree. Yes, absolutely. And, you know, setting aside the technicalities of what Alito did and what he should have done in the wake of doing what he did, it's just a breach of comity, you know, as that term applies to judges and judiciary. And I should think that that would be obvious to everybody. But on the meaning of the flag itself, I was trained as an academic political theorist. And so I think I can explain the meaning of the appeal to heaven flag, in case there's any doubt about it. It's a quotation from John Locke, right? It has nothing to do with Christian nationalism. It's a quotation from John Locke. And it is what Locke recommends when there are intractable conflicts in the body politic. And so he says at one point, for example, that if some ruler turns into a tyrant and will not give way to the people's judgment, then the people will have no choice but, and I quote, to appeal to heaven. What he means by that is stage a revolution against the government, right? And so that flag was an open invitation to violent resistance to government acts that you consider to be illegitimate based on your own standards, your own reading of the Constitution, or what have you. In the current context, I cannot imagine a more dangerous signal to send from a Supreme Court justice who may ultimately be asked to pass on the propriety, for example, of a newly reelected Donald Trump's employment of the Insurrection Act. This scares me. It's more than a breach of judicial comity. It is an invitation to people who don't need much of an invitation to walk through doors that they shouldn't walk through, as we have seen very visibly. So that's all I have to say about this, but it does not surprise me. in least. I will say one other thing. Linda, you are on to something. I have just finished the manuscript of a short book on what I call the dark passions and the threat they pose to liberal democracy. And exhibit A of a dark passion is anger. And it can have all of the effects you fear and then some. And the fact that we have two visibly angry men sitting on the Supreme Court is a very troubling sign for the future of the Republic. And I hope that they're not going to increase their number, but they could.
Thank you so much for that, Bill. That's very, very helpful. All right, before we turn to our next topic, I would like to have a word from our sponsor, Miracle Made. Did you know that your temperature at night can have one of the greatest impacts on your sleep quality? If you wake up too hot or too cold, I highly recommend that you check out Miracle Made's bed sheets. These are inspired by NASA. Apparently, NASA uses silver-infused fabrics and makes temperature regulating easier. And so they incorporated this technology into their bedding so that you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. Also, did you know that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat? It can lead to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth and require three times less laundering. So, it's the self-cooling properties that help you sleep better, they're self-cleaning, and they have comfort and quality without the high price of other luxury brands. So, go to trymiracle.com/begtodiffer to try Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you could save over 40%. Use our promo, begtodiffer, at checkout, and you'll get three free towels and save an additional 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. So the URL is trymiracle.com/begtodiffer. And we thank them for sponsoring this episode of Beg to Differ. All right. We had a poll from the Guardian newspaper this week, British publication. But it was a poll of Americans, and it sheds light on arguably the biggest question before the electorate in this election, namely the state of the economy and voters' views about it. And what they found was quite striking. They found that 55% believe that the U.S. economy is shrinking, and that we are in, and 56% think that the U.S. is experiencing a recession. Though, of course, GDP has been growing at a robust rate. 49% believe that the S&P stock market is down for the year, though, in fact, it is up by 12% so far this year. And there's a lot more where that came from. And so the question is, Joe Klein, I'm going to turn to this to you first on this. We understand that people are upset about high prices, right? I mean, that's just inevitable when you have inflation. People are not going to be happy about high prices. But there is also this belief that everything about the U.S. economy is terrible, that people think that unemployment is at a 50-year high when it's at a 50-year low, for example. Do you think this poll represents an opportunity for the Biden camp to educate people about the true state of the economy, or what? What's your view about what this says?
Well, this poll follows hard on the heels of one of the crosstabs in the New York Times Siena poll last week, which found that over 70% of the American people thought that their economic prospects were really good, and over 70% of the American people thought the economy was really bad. So to me, that represents two things. One is the spillover effects of inflation. Inflation really is the only economic issue aside from, you know, a complete rupture, a depression. Inflation is the only economic issue that really affects a broad mass of the population. But the other thing is that it is an indication of the incoherence of the society right now and the lack of interest in political stuff. It was striking to me, for example, when a few months ago we had this wave of pieces started by Bob Kagan in the Washington Post about how Trump might be a dictator and what a threat that was. And you saw what influence that had on public opinion. Zero. Because in most cases, people don't care about that. They don't understand. I've done a lot of traveling around the world, and so I can tell you what the advantages of democracy are, and I can also demonstrate it by the thousands and thousands of people trying to crash into this country. But most Americans have never, ever seen the consequences of not living in a democracy. And so they're just not paying enough attention. And I remember I said that once on Charlie Rose, and he started criticizing me for criticizing the American people. Well, so be it. I mean, if they're not going to pay attention, it's going to be really, really hard to sustain a democracy. And you can't sustain a democracy. Everybody talks about the importance of freedom, but the importance of responsible citizenship is every bit as important as freedom. You can't have freedom without it. And, you know, these economic numbers represent a level of irresponsibility on the part of citizens who just aren't paying enough attention.
What do you make of that, Damon? Is it evidence that we have a really decadent electorate?
Or a really ignorant one, yeah. This poll is, it really just verifies a lot of other polls that have showed these headwinds that Biden is sailing into. But it puts a little more substance in it on it, and it really, I think, is distressing, because it's not just a vibe thing. This is what people refer to as the kind of vibe session, like people just are kind of in a gloomy mood, even though, and this is picked up in other surveys that ask people things like, how are you doing? And people say, oh, I'm doing great. And then they say, well, how's your region of the country doing? Not very good. Well, how's the country as a whole? Oh, terrible.
Right.
But yet individually, overwhelmingly, people are saying they're doing fine at the individual level. And so at one level, I know Bill and I have talked about this a lot over the last year in the wake of the big inflation we had a year and a half ago and back, that, you know, the rising prices of that period hurt a lot, and people are still smarting from it. Inflation going down doesn't make the prices go down. They stay where they are. It's just a measure of the rate of increase. And so the fact that they're going up less rapidly than they were before isn't going to make people happy. And then, of course, we were able to largely put a stop to inflation, or at least bring it way down, by the Fed raising interest rates, which make people feel poorer in a different way, because now their car loan is more expensive, their credit cards more expensive, their mortgages, if they plan to move, it's now not possible. Buy their first home, they can't afford it anymore. All reasons to say there's something serious about this economic vibe session, if it will. But this poll asks specific factual statements, as you listed, Mona. Like, is the stock market up or down? It's down. No, it's up. Are we in a recession? Yes. No, we're not in a recession. We haven't been in a recession since 2020. where we briefly were in one when the deadliest pandemic in a century hit right all at once before the federal government spent our way out of it very quickly. These specific factual questions, and to see half or slightly more than half of the American people responding with things that are absolutely false. To increase my exasperation at this, you also hear a lot of criticism in the news, and I'm often fighting with people on Twitter about this. Like, do we just blame the New York Times and other mainstream media outlets for being so kind of dark and gloomy about the economy? I think there's some truth to that, but this can't be explained by that. It's not like the New York Times is running headlines about how we're in a recession or how the stock market is down when it's in fact up. The Times doesn't say that. These are things like people taking their gloomy mood and then projecting it onto the world as it is and concocting economic data points to back them up. And that's delusional. And frankly, what can Biden do about this? I have absolutely no idea. I mean, it's one thing to say, I don't know what he can do to make people less angry at him about the fact that they now have to spend $240 a week at the grocery store rather than $180 back in 2020. That's a hard problem. But it's one where you could at least imagine a meeting where policymakers are coming up with ways, or maybe a year ago, where they were coming up with ways to try to deal with that problem. But how do you convince half the country that they have no idea what they're saying about the fundamental facts of reality? And I don't have an answer to that. And it's extremely distressing to how can self-government work in a nation of 330 million people when half of them are living in a reality that is disconnected from the real reality, an alternative reality. It's a huge, huge problem.
Bill, I think, you know, a lot of people were critical of Joe Biden for using the term Bidenomics when a lot of Americans were still smarting from inflation, and still are for that matter. So on the one hand, he got criticism for that. But on the other hand, he gets criticized because people say, you have to brag more about the things that are going right, the way Trump did. You know, you've got to get out there and say, lowest unemployment in 50 years, you know, highest rate of business, new business startups in X number of years. You know, we have the fastest recovery of any nation, industrialized nation post-COVID. All these are all true things. So he has tried, maybe not well enough. What's your sense of his not telling the story in the right way? I mean, obviously, he has to acknowledge the hurt that people feel through inflation. He can't deny that. That's a death sentence, which he has sometimes fallen into, unfortunately. But should he be bragging more? How does he square this circle?
I really fundamentally disagree with people who say that he should have been bragging more. I think it just would have intensified the sense that he's not quite in touch with everyday economic reality as ordinary people are experiencing it. I think that he missed an opportunity to go populist when it would have helped him, you know, to mount, for example, a sustained attack on big food, you know, for its price increases.
I beg to differ.
Why you're still a conservative and I'm not. In fact, I would say there's all sorts of evidence that companies took advantage of a situation to raise prices farther and faster than their underlying cost structure warranted. And if you don't believe me, look at the profits that these corporations are reporting, fueling a record rise in the stock market. Where did these big margins come from? I mean, I can tell you arithmetically, there's only one explanation, but we could have this argument some other time. The fact of the matter is that we live in an age of suspicion, and I think that people with some justice would have applauded the president if he had gotten on top of the inflation issue when he still had a chance at least to associate himself with anti-inflation forces and to send a signal to the American people that he was on their side in this one, that he knew what they were going through. You know, once you've conveyed the sense that you're really out of touch, it's hard to get it back. And when George H.W. Bush, you know, famously had his encounter with electronic checkout at the supermarket, you know, that simply crystallized a sense that was already there. So no, I think bragging would have been a big mistake. And I frankly, my interpretation of this survey is the same as Joe's. People are so disturbed about the prices that they're paying for everything. And by the way, the increases keep on coming. You know, insurance bills are humongous. Car repair bills are out of sight, et cetera, et cetera. You either associate yourself with that phenomenon and the pain it's causing, or you shut up. You don't, you know, it's a real who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes situation. And telling people to believe you rather than their own eyes is not going to get him very far, in my opinion.
Well, Linda, one area that Biden, I think, inarguably could help himself is that he needs to educate people about the fact that inflation has, that they have been fighting inflation and that it has come down. People think it's been a straight line up. And it has not. It spiked, went up to 9% 2022, and it's now down and it's bouncing along, you know, 3-4% in the 3.5% range, which is an accomplishment and something that people arguably don't know. Agree or disagree?
Part of the big problem is that Americans are notoriously innumerate. They don't understand numbers. And when you say inflation has come down, now to people who don't understand inflation and don't understand numbers well, they think there's been an actual fall in prices. What's really happened is that there's been a fall in the rate of inflation. Prices are still going up, but they're going up at a slower rate. And I think that is a big problem and is always a problem. And I don't think Americans understand the economy very well. And they give all too much credit for a good economy to president and all too much blame for a bad economy to a president. What has happened, and the reason we've seen inflation coming down, is largely because of moves that the Federal Reserve has made. And that, I think, increasing interest rates has been helpful in the fight against inflation, but it's also been very hurtful to consumers who happen to be in the market to buy a house for the most part, or a car, some big ticket item that they have to finance. And I think that, you know, again, that's a very difficult thing to explain. I remember back to the Reagan years, I'm sure you do remember as well, how unpopular Reagan was on the economy when in fact interest rates were skyrocketing in order to try to bring inflation down. I mean, it's sort of unfortunate because there is an economic cycle, and the economic cycle that we're in now is going to require the kind of tightening that we've seen the Federal Reserve involved in. By the way, if Donald Trump were to get his way and he were to take away the independence of the Federal Reserve in some way, if he were to get the authority to do that through Congress, we'd be in a real mess, and we could see real inflation. I'm talking about the kind of inflation you have in third world countries where it just goes totally out of control. But this is a really hard issue, and it's very hard to explain. The one area that where I don't understand Americans' ignorance is on the stock market. The stock market is over 40,000. It has more than doubled from the time that Donald Trump took office, and it went up about 10,000 points under Trump, and it's gone up about 13,000 points from its low period in March 20.
Yep. All right. Well, we will have to come back to this, I'm sure, many more times before November.
It might seem like the 2024 U.S. presidential election is happening in a vacuum, but it will have global repercussions.
All of America's allies are thinking very, very hard about how they should reconfigure themselves in case an isolationist president is in the White House.
Swamp Notes from the Financial Times brings you insights on the race through an international lens. You can listen to Swamp Notes on the FT News Briefing podcast every Saturday.
To our final topic, which is our highlight or lowlight of the week, I'm going to ask everybody to do just one and to do them as fast as possible because we're hard up against an out here. So, Damon Linker, short and sweet, please.
Short and sweet. I'm going to recommend an Isaac Chotiner interview in The New Yorker. He's always very lively. This has actually come out, I think, only in the last hour or so while we've been recording this, but I've been looking at it in my spare moments, titled, Is the Biden Campaign Running on False Hope? It's an interview with Democratic Party strategist Simon Rosenberg, who I very much disagree with on a lot of things because he's the hopium guy who just wants to keep saying Biden will do great. Don't worry about it. That is dangerous. And I'm glad that Isaac, I think, makes him look rather embarrassing in that piece. So if you have any interest in seeing that, I recommend the interview. He's always a lively interviewer. That's Isaac Chotiner in The New Yorker.
Thank you. Joe Klein.
In an era full of lowlights, I find myself always searching for the stray highlight. And even if I eschew hopium vehemently, this week, it's a very small item in David Ignatius's column about the prospects for an overriding peace deal in the Middle East. First of all, we should be celebrating David Ignatius whenever we can because he really has the U.S. intelligence community wired.
And on speed dial. He's got them on speed dial.
He sure does. And in that piece, there was a tiny little thing that caught my attention, and it was this. When the helicopter carrying the president of Iran went down, what did the Iranians do? Did they blame us? No. They consulted us. They asked the American intelligence community to help find the helicopter. And I've spent a fair amount of time in Iran. I've spent a fair amount of time studying it. And I think that it's important to note that the Iranians may play aggressive and play obnoxious and play extremist. But in reality, they are very, very cautious. It's a very cautious government. And what we've seen over the last 4 or 5 months is that when we went upside their heads about their aggressive use of surrogates, they stopped using them. And they want to be in a dialogue with us, which can be very important if things get out of control in that easily uncontrollable region. So I think that's a small thing, but I think it's a source of optimism. We're not dealing with Nazi Germany here. We're dealing with rational actors who disagree with us and very much disagree with Israel.
Okay, Bill Galston.
Well, rarely for me a highlight. A reporter and columnist at Vox by the name of Andrew Prokop, whom I've never met, has written a very intelligent piece with the title, If Trump Wins, What Would Hold Him Back? The guardrails of democracy reined him in last time, but they're weakening. It's concise, thoughtful, and sensible.
Thank you. Linda.
I'm going to go with a highlight, and it comes from one of my favorite sources on foreign policy and human rights issues, and that's Freedom House Perspectives. It's entitled Three Books to Help You Understand Nations in Transit 2024. That is the study that Freedom House puts out that talks about hybrid regimes and talks about whether they're becoming more democratic or more restrictive. And if our listeners are anything like me, there are a lot more important books out there that we never get a chance to read. So this is a review of three books in particular. One, Russia and Ukraine, Entangled Histories, Diverging States. The other, Tainted Democracy, Viktor Orban and the Subversion of Hungary. And finally, Armenia's Velvet Revolution, Authoritarian Decline and Civil Resistance in a Multipolar World. It's a well-written review. The books I won't have time to read, but I think I at least got the gist of it from this particular essay.
Thank you. Mine is a low light, extremely low, namely the Marjorie Taylor Greene tweet that began this process of circulating a new MAGA conspiracy theory, namely that the FBI was ready to assassinate Donald Trump when they executed a search of Mar-a-Lago. The entire thing is preposterous. You can read about it in Morning Shots by Andrew Egger from The Bulwark. But the frightening thing is that it went from the fevered mind of a MAGA fabulist called Julie Kelly straight to Marjorie Taylor Greene and straight to Truth Social and Trump retweeting it in the space of about 20 hours, which means that the acceleration of disinformation, falsehood, and absurdity is just increasing. And I am certain that there will be a large number of Americans now who will believe that Joe Biden was actually prepared to assassinate Donald Trump when they did the Mar-a-Lago search. And that is the level of falsehood that we are up against, and it's only getting worse. With that, I want to thank Joe Klein for joining us, and of course our regulars. I want to thank our sound engineer Jonathan Siri and our producer Jim Swift, and of course our wonderful viewers and listeners. And Beg to Differ will return next week, as every week. Thank you.
This holiday season, reach for the one butter that never disappoints, Kerrygold. Made with milk from grass-fed cows on Irish family farms, it's rich, creamy, and perfect for baking. Whether browning butter for cookies or crafting the flakiest pie crust, Kerrygold's high butterfat content makes all the difference in flavor and texture. Holiday treats will taste extraordinary.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.